Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and it's kind of loud for a watch. This hour, the precision of a jeweled watch movement. The lack of precision in the mission to confront the Islamic State. This hour, we will journey from a discussion of worries about U.S. strategic military imprecision to marveling at a mechanical watchmaker's meticulous skill at repairing microscopic gears and springs.
My favorite watch, solid gold case that my father gave me. I still wear it. I got it on my birthday when I was 12 years old. Still keeps perfect time.
Stay with us as we meet later this hour Terry Irby, the jolly, happy watchmaker who grew up in Arkansas and went to the big city to repair the $300,000 timepieces on the wrists of the rich and powerful in New York. We'll also have stops along the way to learn how cops are nabbing cash from drivers who aren't even charged with a crime, and we'll spend some time thinking about Apple's play to make a watch that does everything. But we begin with Barack Obama, a president trying to end two wars, now reluctantly having to outline a plan for confronting the Islamic State in the Middle East. The president reportedly is not hesitant to confront the barbarism of ISIS, but the open-ended military engagement in the Middle East that Obama is expected to announce today is a road this president has wanted to avoid going down for all 6 years of his administration. We'll find out exactly what's going to happen later today. Joining us now is Andrew Bacevich, a Vietnam veteran and a professor emeritus at Boston University. His latest book, Breach of Trust, is now out in paperback. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Andrew.
Hello.
So what do you think is possible here in outlining a strategy to confront ISIS? I mean, we're not going to have a tank invasion of Syria. So what's possible here? Sketch something out for me.
Well, all the indications suggest that the president's going to ante up a bit more what he's been doing so far. In other words, that there's the hope that American air power can combine with surrogates on the ground to constitute a force of sufficient effectiveness that will be able to defeat ISIS. And I think that the big question here really is whether or not those surrogates are going to be up to the task.
Is this the Abbottabad raid that killed Osama bin Laden sort of writ large here, or something fundamentally different?
Well, it is, I think, that notion writ large, and it reflects, my guess is, it reflects the president's own reading of the principal military lessons of the post-9/11 era. And the most important of those lessons is that our wars these days tend to turn into exceedingly long campaigns that yield inconclusive outcomes. And the longer they drag on, the higher the political costs here at home as people who once favored the war change their mind. I mean, right at the present moment, there appears to be a considerable consensus in favor of vigorous military action. But will that consensus still exist 6 months from now or a year from now or 2 years from now? Those have to be things that are on the president's mind.
You know, during the Cold War, an open-ended conflict sort of worked. There was enormous spending that benefited all kinds of constituencies in the Pentagon. And it was fine when really the only service members who were involved in actual sort of deployment were in submarines or in strategic bombers or in missile silos. But when you have boots on the ground, it's fundamentally different. You can't really confront ISIS exclusively with drones. At some point, you're going to have patrols facing the kind of IED, hazards of Iraq and Syria.
You may well be right. But again, if you think about what we've experienced thus far in our war in Iraq and, of course, in our war in Afghanistan, it's really not clear that American boots on the ground are able to get the job done. It's not any criticism of the bravery and competence of our soldiers, but we are outsiders, and our efforts to pacify, to bring order to these disordered societies have tended to backfire. And that's why I think my reading of what the president's logic is here is he'd like to see some people who are not outsiders step up to the plate and be able to take on this responsibility to bring order. And we, of course, help in ways that we're best suited to provide help, and that's air power.
But it seems that if we look at Iraq and Afghanistan, that those are examples of a real failure on the part of those missions. We have not been able to train a competent military or police force in Iraq. And the last time we checked in Afghanistan, the forces in Afghanistan that the U.S. is training are often training their weapons on U.S. soldiers.
I think you put your finger on the real weakness of what the president seems to be doing. As I said a couple of minutes ago, I think the real question here is, will surrogates prove to be up to the task? Now, the Iraqi security forces have performed in very disappointing ways. On the other hand, we have the Peshmerga, the Kurdish security force, which hasn't performed brilliantly, but I think is generally seen as a more competent and better motivated force. There are other actors in the region that certainly ought to care about trying to deal with ISIS and frankly should care more than we care because they are more directly threatened. So the key here is, who are the partners who are going to carry the brunt of the combat on the ground while we assist indirectly?
Can you give me a sense of the conversations that people in the Pentagon, people maybe in uniform, are having about the prospect of some new mission? I went back and reviewed some of the really extraordinary documentation of what went on in Iraq and Afghanistan, and you know, books like Outpost and The Good Soldiers, and the extraordinary cost that was paid by soldiers who had to deal with these, you know, holding territory that ultimately was meaningless in the end. I mean, I just wonder if there's any appetite within the Pentagon for something that isn't crystal clear.
Well, it's been a long time since I've been in the military, so I can't say for sure, but my speculation would be that there is a high level of consciousness about the little that we gained given the exertions that we undertook. And if you're a young major or a sergeant first class, you've probably got three tours under your belt, and if somebody's going to say to you, hey, I got a great idea, let's go do another occupation of Iraq, I think it would be quite understandable that you would say, geez, I'm not so sure.
Well, let's shift gears here for a moment. There was a really amazing piece, I thought, or thought-provoking piece in The New Yorker this week from David Remnick, who focused a little bit on this Hillary Clinton comment that suggests that there is no policy here. There is no strategy here. Great nations need organizing principles, Hillary Clinton reportedly told The Atlantic, and don't do stupid stuff is not an organizing principle. Now, Remnick said, yes, Obama seems to be kind of fuzzy and mushy in some of the language he uses. But Remnick sort of pointed out that over the 6 years of the Obama administration, we do have coming close to an agreement on Iran and nukes. The sanctions seem to be settling things down in Ukraine. You know, he really is someone who does not want to pointlessly use American military power.
Well, I mean, frankly, I'll settle for don't do stupid things as a principle. It's certainly preferable to the principle of his predecessor, Obama's predecessor, which was to let's go see how many stupid things we can do and hope that they'll work out. That said, no, I don't think that there is an overarching strategy in Washington today that guides U.S. policy. I mean, if you mentioned the Cold War a couple of minutes ago. And God knows that during the Cold War, the United States made any number of mistakes, starting with Vietnam. That said, this concept of containment did provide a sort of organizing principle around which policy could evolve. The idea was, if we can at least prevent the Soviets from expanding, from increasing their power, from intruding into places where they didn't have any influence, that ultimately we would prevail in this competition with communism. And more or less, that's the way the story finally played itself out. There is no comparable principle that guides policy with regard to the larger problem of Islamic radicalism.
Are we buying into a kind of domino theory with the Islamic State here because we have no other alternative?
Well, I mean, I personally think that the rhetoric about the Islamic State, any number of people claiming that the Islamic State poses a threat to the United States of America, that's way over the top. The Islamic State does not. And this is an entity of what? 15,000 fighters with no air force and no navy, no weapons of mass destruction. You know, the notion that poses a threat to the United States is nonsense. The Islamic State does pose a threat to the region. It is exacerbating the instability of the region. And we have, as we ourselves have done, and we have an interest in trying to restore some semblance of stability. And therefore, it makes sense for us to participate in an effort to defeat the Islamic State. But we really ought to temper the rhetoric, I think. And in doing so, we can come to a more reasoned response to the problem.
Well, we'll see how much precision there is in the president's remark today, and we'll see how broad of a coalition there is to go after the Islamic State. Andrew Bacevich, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Andrew Bacevich is the author of Breach of Trust, out in paperback. He's a Vietnam War veteran and professor emeritus at Boston University. Later this hour, is it a digital handcuff or a fashion statement? The smartwatch from Apple. A third of Americans who bought a wearable product, though, ditched it within 6 months. What does that mean for Apple? Maybe we just haven't come up with the right product yet. If you could come up with your own wearable technology, what would it be? An ingenious idea from Lakeport, California, a wearable beer brewing contraption. What could be better than that? This person writes from Salt Lake City, Utah. You're asking for a wearable to increase computing power. Extra RAM for my brain would be nice. I could wear it as a headband or in my glasses. It's a device that you could have as a replacement for companionship. Peaks Island, Maine, one of you asks for an Android girlfriend. And one of you would rather that technology just help you shut out technology.
My name is Benjamin Dorr. I'm calling from Bainbridge Island, Washington, just off from Seattle. I would love a device that would lock me out of all my devices until my creative work was finished and my house was clean and my meals cooked and I've spent time with my kids. I would just love that device that would only allow me certain hours onto my other devices so that I could actually live my life in a present and undistracted world away from my phone and computer from time to time.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can join the conversation. Coming up later on The Takeaway, one of literature's highest awards, the Man Booker Prize, could go to an American for the first time in history. Author Joshua Ferris has been shortlisted for his novel To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, Takeaway Book Club pick back in June. Here's an excerpt from the book read by Takeaway listener Max Wall.
The mouth is a weird place. Not quite inside and not quite out. Not skin and not organ, but something in between. Dark, wet, admitting access to an interior most people would rather not contemplate. Where cancer starts, where the heart is broken, where the soul might just fail to turn up.
More on the Man Booker Prize later this hour. It's The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. And Moo.com, an online print and design company providing software and tools to create business cards, flyers, and triple-thick luxe cards. More at Moo.com.
Police under the law can confiscate assets from suspects and the familiar cases of drug kingpins losing their airplanes, houses, and boats. Makes intuitive sense as a punishment, even if a judge isn't making the decision as part of a criminal sentencing. But why would cops around the U.S. be permitted to confiscate billions of dollars from thousands of drivers, even though they weren't charged with any crimes? According to a new report from the Washington Post, police across the U.S. have taken $2.5 billion from people without a warrant or pressing criminal charges since 2001. The justification for these seizures comes from something called civil asset forfeiture laws. Robert O'Hara of the Washington Post joins us. He's co-author of a three-part series on all this. Robert, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
I have to say, quite frankly, I do not understand what is going on here. I mean, what is this? How does this work?
Well, what it is a confluence of well-intended powers. One of them goes back to the drug wars that you mentioned. And the aim of the civil asset forfeiture law was to take down very clever, powerful drug kingpins by taking their stuff when the government had enough of a belief that it was ill-gotten gains. And police did this for years, increasingly through the 90s. And after 9/11, the Justice Department, DEA, and various parts of the Department of Homeland Security thought this would be a good idea to encourage among local officers, towns, county deputies and such to use this approach called highway interdiction to go after bulk cash. And it appears that many of the police realized that they could do good and do themselves well by being very, very aggressive in the hunt for cash.
But I just don't understand what the mission is here. We're not like hunting for cash to stop terrorists. Are we hunting for cash just to annoy drivers and, you know, make money for the police? Where's the cash go?
Remember, go back to 9/11.
Right.
There was a great deal of fear. A lot of the smugglers, putative terrorists, presumably, did not go to the airports because of the increased security there and hit the highways. And so now there's a new mandate for police. And then suddenly there was a cottage industry of trainers teaching them the techniques of not only how to search through a car, but how to talk to drivers and how to present their findings in court. And tens of thousands of police were trained in highway interdiction, in many cases with financial support from the Justice Department and the Department of Homeland Security.
So let's say I'm a driver and I encountered one of these cops who'd been trained in the way that you describe. You know, what would happen? I mean, what would I be told? And, you know, how would they get me to empty my wallet?
There's a standard script that we developed out of reading scores, hundreds of court cases. And it turns out there's an approach that's taught by these schools, and it basically works this way. The Supreme Court has said that it's perfectly fine for police to use a traffic infraction, as long as there's a real traffic infraction, to make a stop. And that could be you drift across the center line, you didn't turn your turn signal on soon enough, or maybe you have tinted windows. They make the stop, and then they engage in a series of questions that are intended to find inconsistencies in the driver's story. Now, I should tell you that it seems clear to me in talking to dedicated law enforcement officials that this is a legitimate tool that, if used well, can help make us all safer. A lot of the police have used it to get warrantless searches. They say, I now see an inconsistency in the story. I see indicators of potential criminal activity. They think that a deodorizer hanging from the rearview mirror, trash on the floor, energy drinks, all of this stuff adds up. They use a phrase called the totality of the circumstances. And at some point, they may ask the driver for permission to search, or if their belief is strong enough, they may call in a dog, drug sniffing dog. And either way, if the dog indicates there might be drugs or if the police have permission, they'll go into the car. And once they're in the car, they make so many stops that it seems that they make, on a fairly regular basis, hits, and they find cash, and then they decide whether it's likely to be used for criminal activity or drug running.
Well, that sort of, move from a traffic violation to a suspicious inconsistency pattern, which results in a large search, is exactly what's going on here. This is audio from your investigation at the Washington Post. Let's listen.
Is there any large amounts of cash in the vehicle?
There's nothing.
Okay. Would it be okay if I did a quick search of the vehicle and just make sure there's nothing in there?
For what reason?
Well, it's just part of what we do out here.
And he's basically going from somebody didn't signal properly when they changed lanes to looking at a, you know, air freshener in the car, deodorizer, like you said, a radar detector, other inconsistencies in this suspect, John Anderson's answers. Did they actually get cash from this fellow?
They did. And the officer making that stop is the lead instructor for the leading training firm in the country. And what happened after that is, they found $25,000 plus in money. Almost immediately after, the officer handcuffed this driver and began asking him to sign a waiver. And if he signed the waiver, the police said, you can go on your way. You can say that this isn't your money. And in the end, that's what happened.
And they took it.
They took it. In fact, on the video, he says, I'm going to take this money. Have you called the bank? He said to a colleague that was there.
So is this an overreach on the part of police? What's the next step here? And is the Justice Department expected to respond?
The overreach is not for me to say because I'm not, you know, expert enough in the law, but we did interview two constitutional law scholars, and both of them said that the 2+ hour stop became, quote, unlawful at about 14 minutes when he detained the driver to wait for the dog to come. The Justice Department in this case, presumably up to them to, if they're interested, to look at this case. The video is incredibly compelling viewing, and in fact, I think provides an essence of the entire investigation. And of course, if you don't mind me saying, I would recommend people go and find it in our stories.
3-part series in the Washington Post, co-author Robert O'Hara on police stopping people and seizing as much as $2.5 billion in cash without a warrant or pressing criminal charges, something that's gone on since 2001. Robert O'Hara, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
When I look at most people's wrists, I see a watch. The mechanical miracles that cost a large fortune, we'll talk about those in a moment, or the athletic watches that are like personal trainers, or the cheap throwaway digital fashion watches that match your socks. When Apple looks at your wrist, it sees a multi-billion dollar beachhead to a whole new digital invasion of the human body.
Apple Watch is the most personal device we've ever created. We set out to make the best watch in the world.
Yes, it's time once again for the would-be cool to hand over some more cash to the folks at Apple. Its first adopter maniacs are lining up for smartwatches.
A lot of people think that we're paid by Apple to do this. I mean, but we're not. We just like the experience. Just waiting here is like, it's like cool. Like, who does this? Who else, you know, that does this besides the people that are actually here, you know? So, I mean, it's different. We're just Apple fanatics.
Apple may be getting the most attention right now, but wrist wearables are coming. We're about to be hosed down by a whole new stream of smart stuff. Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech, joins us from the TechCrunch conference in San Francisco. Ben, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hey, John. Thank you.
So the wearable wrist watches and the Apple Watch is just the beginning of a whole big movement. Can you describe where this is headed and how much of a test this is of the whole market, the Apple Watch?
Well, it's actually interesting. I mean, in some ways, the Apple Watch is a late comer to the wearables game. There have been lots of things on the market for a while. The Fitbit, the Nike Fuel Band, Jawbone. These are all wearable devices that track our fitness and pull a lot of other data from our daily behavior. The Apple Watch, you know, is banking on the fact that by some estimates, 40% of U.S. consumers are interested in buying a smartwatch. Now, that sounds kind of high to me, but it's part of a large and growing market that Apple is definitely banking on, and other companies are too. Samsung has released smartwatches this year, so has LG, Motorola, the Moto 360 is another example. So this is certainly a large and growing field right now. The big question is, will consumers actually buy in?
And the idea is really the watch has to converge all of the smart features into this little screen. And, you know, we already see people walking around with their heads down. If they're going to be walking around with their faces at their wrist, I mean, people are going to end up walking into trees. But that's really the test here, right?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, a lot of companies haven't really been able to unlock yet is really creating a watch that people want to use. You know, these days, at least in the mobile space, phones are getting bigger. You saw Apple yesterday release a larger phone that some people have been clamoring for a while. And the idea of making things smaller and having a tiny little watch face that you would interact with is a big question mark. Now, Apple would argue, of course, that the Apple Watch is designed really, really well to do that. It's got all this different functionality. It's got a little so-called digital crown on the side of the watch that's like a little spinny dial that you can turn and change the functionalities of the watch. It allows you to interact with the watch via Siri. You can talk to the watch. You can actually doodle on the watch and send doodles to your friends. And so Apple, I think, is, you know, banking on its ability and the ability of Apple's Johnny Ive to design something that people will actually want to interact with.
Your impressions?
Well, John, I will admit that I'm an Android, so I've been looking actually at the Moto 360 as a watch that I've been interested in. But, you know, I think the Apple Watch has a lot of really nice looking design on it. In its, you know, in its own Apple way, it looks very sleek. There's three different versions of the watch. Each has two different sizes. I did not see yesterday a product that was revolutionary. I think, you know, it's been, let's see, about 4 years since the iPad was unveiled by Apple. This was, of course, a time at which Steve Jobs was leading the company. And that was a revolutionary product, as had been the iPod, the iPhone, the Mac, and so many things before it. I didn't see that yesterday. I felt like it was a product that, yes, I will want to buy, but I don't have to have.
Well, you know, and this is, you know, the way Apple works. I mean, this first version may be for the fanatics, but we'll see whether the word of mouth and the sort of general sense of this is cool makes it into people's fashion sense. And that's the idea. Is this a intermediate step, this watch, towards a whole sense of digital fashion that may end up being, you know, the smart tooth filling by the time we get to the end of the game here?
Well, I think that is true. And a lot of people are looking to Apple to sort of lead the pack, even if it's kind of a late arriver by some standards. In my mind, the most exciting potentials when it comes to wearable technology are things that maybe are a fashion statement, but are also actually maybe not even visible. Things in your clothing that can monitor your heart rate or monitor your health and deliver you data wirelessly and do it at low power. I mean, think about this. The Apple Watch, you're going to have to take off every night, John, and sit on a charger. And, you know, I don't know yet that consumers are fully all in.
Well, Gwen Stefani was in the audience there, invited along with, you know, some fashion industry leaders. Will the fashion industry buy this?
I think that there's a possibility there, and I do think that Apple, you know, Apple's that company, right, that has, at least in the past, designed products that are a fashion statement. The iPhone as, you know, the best example. And, you know, you think about the fact that Apple is expecting to sell between 60 and 70 million iPhone 6s. That's just the newest version of its iPhone. And I think that if it expects to sell as many watches, then yes, we are looking at the possibility of the fashion industry buying into this and consumers buying into this.
How far away are we from smart tattoos and smart piercings, right, Ben?
Someday, although I'm not sure I'm going to spend $349 on one of those either.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech, talking to us from the TechCrunch conference in San Francisco. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. Learn more at TiVo.com.
Jewels and springs and tiny gears and not a molecule of silicon anywhere.
I don't want to work on something little. I always like a challenge, something that I have to solve and on my own, you know?
That's a young man from the Bronx, Edwin Loregi, who's keeping an old tech tradition alive, watch repair and watchmaking. Loregi is an apprentice to master watch repairman Terry Irby. Irby trained with his dad trained with his dad. Terry, who today is technical director for Turno's American business, says watch repair offers steady work on mechanical timepieces that are more intricate than ever, despite the age of chips and flat screens.
I have been repairing watches for 50 years now. Started as a small boy with my family. My family's are all watchmakers, including my sister and brother and father, who's passed away a few years ago. But we fixed thousands of watches over the last 50 years.
A family of watchmakers.
Family of watchmakers. Yeah. That's how you learn. I mean, there's not many schools, you know, in the 50s and 60s that we had access to. So it was basically the father would teach the rest of the family. Even I have aunts and uncles that pursued this career. It's, you know, sort of an unusual profession that not a lot of people know about. And you can't really learn it unless somebody can really take you under their wing and train you.
Now, Terry, I have this vision of your family. You're all sitting around wearing these magnifiers on your head and trying to...
Well, we all use magnifiers.
Yeah. What are the, that's not the name for it, right?
It's an eye loop.
Eye loop, right, right.
And we all use them. The first thing you do is you have to learn to work under that because the parts are quite small. Some of them are smaller than the head of a pen, of course. But we have to be able to see what we're doing if we're going to fix it or inspect it. We also, of course, back in the 50s and 60s, repaired a lot of clocks. My father was an inspector for one of the local railroad companies in town, and so the people on the train would actually bring their pocket watches in and have my father inspect it. I can remember that as a small boy. None of the electronic gadgets that you see now.
And when you work, what's the background? Is it a black background? Is it a white background?
We actually use a light green background because it's soft on the eye reflection. You don't want light coming back into your eyes all day long. And number one, to do this for 50 years, you have to take care of your eyes.
Yeah.
You have to have a good good vision and be able to identify all of these small parts. I mean, there's, you know, 200 or 300 parts in one of these.
And thinking about the parts, what is the most, you know, SLB, tiniest little ornery part that always is getting away from you there?
The part that gets away, and all watchmakers have this problem, there's tiny springs, less than an eighth of an inch long and the thickness of a hair, with about three coils that can jump about 15 feet if you let it get away from you. The spring tension is amazing. So the first thing we do is make sure that we don't lose any parts because it could take me an hour to make a part like that if I lose it. So the first thing you learn, don't lose any parts.
I would have trouble with that.
Everybody has trouble. You have to train yourself and think about it continually. Otherwise, you will lose parts.
Now, up in the Bronx, Edwin Loregi.
Yes.
The idea of watches up there is not so much making them as it is to just sort of selling them.
Just selling them, you're right. Selling them and repairing them. And like they mostly have small jewelry shops and things like that. So it's mostly repair and sell.
How'd you get interested in this?
Well, since I was a little boy, I really was always into breaking things and repairing them, you know, as a little boy.
What's the first thing you broke and repaired?
Actually, it was like I remember breaking my brother's. Like, he had a car, a small toy car.
Mechanical car, yeah.
Yeah, and I ended up, you know, taking out the wheel because I was curious, like, what's inside here, you know? But I ended up fixing it, you know, gluing back the wheel.
And Terry, Edwin has some natural talent here?
He had a lot of natural talent. In a couple weeks, we could tell because he always wanted the smallest watch we had in the shop to work on.
Right. Really?
I always wanted, like, a challenge. A challenge for me is I'm going to learn more throughout. I don't want to work on something little. I always like a challenge, something that I have to solve and on my own, you know?
Don't give me that big Breitling. I don't care about that. Just give me one of these little Rolexes, these tiny little guys.
Right.
Yeah. And what amazed you about the watch repair process?
In the watch, to me, each part, they each have their own little... world.
And it's a world.
The way I put it, it's like a little world. So we have to, little by little, you got to fix each part just to make that one world, right?
Do you have names for the little creatures in that world? Do you? Like the little spring over here? This is Wilbur and this is...
I tend to, you know, make my own little names. And
you do?
Yeah. You have to talk to them, you know. It makes, you know, only makes it fun. You tell them, you know what, I'm going to fix you up.
Really?
I end up doing it, yeah.
I wish you could see his face and his hands moving around here. It's like the springs are all just like standing up going,
yeah, because it's
okay,
not,
Edwin,
it's,
whatever you want to do.
It's not easy. It's not. You got to have a lot of patience and you have to be very precise.
So what did you notice about Edwin's talent and sensibility, and he already loves the mechanical over the electronic stuff.
He had a passion and a determination to fix it, no matter how long it took, and he would stay there. We'd offer him breaks periodically throughout the day. Edwin really didn't want to take a break. Mm-mm. I said, Edwin, take 15 minutes. Terry, let me just finish this. I almost have it back together. Give me another 5 minutes, another 10 minutes. And that was really, I could see that this young man really had a future in our industry.
And you care about that because, I mean, you know, after you, there's not a lot of, a busload of watchmakers.
No. In fact, our numbers are really declining every year. I mean, we're down to thousands now, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 at most. Whereas in the 50s, we had 60,000 watchmakers and probably one-tenth the watches. So we really understood the need to really to introduce as many young people as possible to this profession. And that's what we do.
You wearing a watch?
Yeah, I'm wearing a Bulova 23 jewels. It's transportation special.
How about you?
I have a Bulova too that was made in Woodside, New York in, you know, the late 40s, early 50s. I got it on my birthday when I was 12 years old. I wear it a few times a year, but I thought it'd be nice. I wear it today. It's sort of an unusual piece. My favorite watch, solid gold case that my father gave me, and it's been a treasure for all these years.
Edwin and Terry, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Terry Irby is the technical director for Tourneau, and Edwin Laregi is a former student of Terry's and a graduate of Tourneau's watchmaking program. From precision back to the fuzzier concept of what President Obama is going to lay out tonight when he addresses the nation to talk about strategy to combat ISIS, we talked about what the road ahead might look like at the start of the hour with foreign policy expert Andrew Bacevich.
If you're a young major or a sergeant first class, you've probably got 3 tours under your belt. And if somebody's going to say to you, hey, I got a great idea, let's go do another occupation of Iraq, I think it would be quite understandable that you would say, geez, I'm not so sure.
That's the possible reaction from men and women in uniform, but we're putting this to you. What level of warfare and military intervention are you willing to get behind and support based on what the president will say today? Are you feeling a sense of fatigue after more than a decade of war? Does the threat of ISIS warrant a new round of fighting, boots on the ground? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Can we handle this purely with air power? Thanks so much for listening. We always love to hear from you. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo.com, offering business cards with Printfinity, the option for a different image on every card in a pack. More at Moo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.